Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In honor of World Philosophy Day, which is this week, USU philosophy professors are inviting you to ask us anything. That event is at the Logan Library on Thursday, which is World Philosophy Day. It starts at 5 p.m. again at the Logan Library. The panel will consist of USU professors Charlie Heeneman, Harrison Kleiner, Michael Otteson, and Alex Barrientos. After a short introduction, questions will be taken from the audience, and the event will be moderated by Professor Mike Ashfield. Free coffee and refreshments will be provided. And today we'll have some of those panel members. We'll talk with USU philosophy faculty members Charlie Heeneman, Rachel Robinson-Green, and Michael Otteson. So we welcome in Rachel Robinson-Green again from last year. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
If people remember the program, right, we had you on the program. We welcome in Charlie Heeneman.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Michael Otteson.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. Let's start with introductions. I'll just have you introduce yourself, and then we can talk about some interesting bits of your bio. Rachel Robinson-Green, tell us a bit about yourself.
I'm an assistant professor here at Utah State. I study primarily ethics and moral psychology.
Ethics and moral psychology. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm reading from your bio in the College of Arts and Sciences and the Department of History, Cultures, and Ideas. By the way, it's been rearranging at USU, and so that's new to me. History, Cultures, and Ideas. New to you guys, too, I suppose.
Yeah. Apparently, we just had a big discussion about the name of our department, and it was the Department of History, and then became History, Cultures, and Ideas, and apparently it's going back to the Department of History now.
Oh, is it? Okay. I didn't get that memo.
Yeah,
okay.
No, there's something about it's breaking news, and yeah, something in favor of simplicity there.
So we're assuming culture and ideas is subsumed into history.
Yeah, and we're also tired of ideas anyway.
We're tired of ideas, although we're going to spend the hour talking about ideas here. So you're spending your careers talking about ideas.
That's true.
So Rachel Robinson-Green, we can get into this a little bit later. You're the author of the book Edibility and In Vitro Meat, Ethical Considerations. That's pretty interesting. And co-author of the book Conspiracy Theories in the Time of Coronavirus. Definitely want to talk about that one
with
you a little bit later here. So, and you serve as Secretary of the Public Philosophy Network, Secretary of Culture and Animals Foundation, Chair-elect of the Intercollegiate Ethics Bowl. So some things to talk about there. Charlie Heeneman, tell us a bit about yourself.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I'm a professor of philosophy here at USU. I study mostly history of philosophy, really from 1500 on. Anything before 1500, I shunt over to my friend Michael here. Mm-hmm. But once science gets going, then I get interested. It's pretty broad interests beyond that in history of philosophy. Yeah.
All right. And then I went to Heenomaniac.com.
Right.
People should go there.
Yeah, it's a blog that I used to feed regularly, but haven't fed recently. So.
Okay. So you say when you were 10 years old, you produced and directed a short documentary about the life of Abraham Lincoln. You then dressed yourself up as Abraham Lincoln and showed the film to anyone passing through local hospital's electrocardiogram unit where your mom worked. That tells us a lot about you, Charlie.
I was a weird little kid, and I grew up to be a weird old man.
That shows some ambition. How old were you?
I must have been maybe 10, something like that. And, yeah, for whatever reason, just fell in love with Abraham Lincoln. And my older brother was a filmmaker, and I wanted to be like him, too. So I started to make all these films, including one about Abraham Lincoln. And then, yeah, why not, you know, go the whole route and, dressed up like him and so on. But, I think I had a kind of dramatic flair as a kid. That's how I expressed it.
Yeah. And you say as a senior in high school, you heard Zane Pouts.
Yeah, there's an interesting story there. I won't go all into it because it takes too long. But, yeah, this might connect with some listeners. Going through school, I'd never really heard of philosophy, or I kind of associated it in my mind with, like, the prophets of the Old Testament or something like that. I didn't know that anyone could be a philosopher in contemporary times, but... I had a great high school teacher, and he brought in a philosopher from a local university, and this was Zane Pouts. And everything he said about philosophy just lit me up, and I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Mm. Yeah.
And so you got into philosophy from there and as a career.
Yes, yeah, it's worked out pretty well so far. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me link back to you, Rachel. I'm going to ask each of you, so what got you into philosophy? What was the, was there a seminal event?
I didn't even know what philosophy was when I started college. I went into college a criminal justice major, and I thought maybe I'd become a lawyer, and then I took a philosophy class and just fell in love.
Took a class? Yeah. Now, Charlie, you were saying before we went on the air that students in high school are exposed to a lot of different things, which might give them ideas about what they want to do in college, but often not philosophy.
Yeah, philosophy isn't covered in high schools, or at least not reliably. There may be some high schools that have it could be a philosophy club or a philosophy unit or something like that, but it's not covered reliably. And so students who come our way in the university, maybe they saw an interesting YouTube, or maybe they had, you know, a kind of interesting high school teacher that mentioned it to them. But they always have an interesting story to tell about how they got into philosophy. And sometimes they just needed a class Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 10:30, and this fit the bill.
Yeah.
And so in they come. And I'll have to say, for some students, it's not their cup of tea. They just don't like it. And for other students, this is exactly what they've been waiting for.
Yeah. So, Michael Austin, tell me a bit about yourself.
Yeah, assistant professor of philosophy in the same department as my colleagues here. I grew up in California, and then when I was 12, I moved to Draper, Utah. And then when I went to college here at Utah State as an undergrad. So that's kind of when I got into philosophy, where I, as a freshman, was sort of going through a transitional period in my life where I was sort of reconstructing, you know, who I was and what I thought about things. And I got hooked up with some philosophy events, and it kind of snowballed from there.
All right. What was it about philosophy?
Yeah, I'm drawn to big questions. Questions, who are we? How should we live our lives? What's the ultimate nature of reality? These are the sort of questions that I just can't stop thinking about.
Ah, yeah. So. Perfect career then.
Yes.
Did you ever take Charlie's class?
I sure did. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I took a number of classes from Charlie. He taught social ethics, and I took that class from him. That was delightful.
I'm surprised. Of all the classes I teach, that's sort of the one that I always feel I do the worst on. But just shows how dedicated you are, Michael.
I don't know about that, but and then I took his Kant and his German philosophy kind of after Kant class. So that's a formative class for me, and you know, had many other interactions with Charlie over the years via various clubs and extracurricular events as well. So.
And you're the founder and host of the Aggie Agora.
That's
am I
right.
Producing that podcast?
Yeah, that's right. So I haven't updated that in a while, but that's kind of a podcast where I talk about various issues that interest me and oftentimes broadly touch on philosophy. So
I'm reading your CV here. Language skills, Latin and Greek.
Yes.
Reading comprehension. I guess if you can do ancient philosophy, you got to have some Latin and Greek.
Yeah, that's right. So I, in addition to studying philosophy at Utah State as an undergraduate, I did some other things, and one of those was classics. And so I did minored in Latin and Greek.
Let me jump in. I'll ask a couple questions I asked last year. People won't remember. and I hadn't remembered until I pulled up my document here. But what is philosophy? I don't know who wants to tackle that. Charlie?
I can do this. I was hesitating here just because Michael also has some great responses to this. But one kind of stand-to joke that I go to is somebody once said that philosophy is taking questions that occur naturally to children and then pursuing them with skills that come naturally to lawyers.
Ah.
And so philosophy always begins in wonder, a wonder about what human beings are, why we're here, what a human life should be, what I owe to other people, and so on, what's real. And these are questions that, in fact, there's great studies on philosophy in young children, and children just naturally raise these questions. They're very often, those questions are beaten out of the children in one way or another. But some people continue to ask those questions. But then it doesn't just stay in wonder. Philosophers use logic and argumentation and a kind of dialectic between providing a thesis and providing counterexamples or objections to that thesis, so that we can try to understand a little bit more about what the possibilities are. If we don't come to a final answer about what a human life is for or what the purpose of a human life is, at least we start to rule out some of the options and we start to see what definitely isn't going to be a very good answer.
Michael, you've been advertised as having a great answer to this question.
I don't know about that, and the trick being, of course, that what is philosophy is itself a philosophical question and is contested.
Yeah.
So there's lots of ways of getting at this. Charlie mentioned Aristotle's sort of philosophy or begins in wonder, and I like that a lot. Some people talk about philosophy as the study of the good, the true, and the beautiful. Though I also like Charlie's addition that there's a certain kind of universality and systematicity to philosophy, that philosophers are studying what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful, but they're looking for sort of foundational principles. They're looking for principles that are as universal as and broad as possible, and they're using a certain kind of systematicity and logical argumentation to get at answers to these sorts of questions. And so I think that characterizes most of the philosophical tradition as we understand it, as most philosophers, wherever you find them on the planet and in whatever time period, are sort of concerned with these sorts of foundational, universal, and ultimate questions.
Rachel, what's your answer?
When I was a student in Intro to Philosophy, the textbook that we had was called The Great Conversation. And I always really liked that philosophy is a conversation not just among contemporaries, but across time. And the skills I tell my students, or I hope that my students will take from my courses, are the ability to construct arguments and to respond charitably to the arguments coming from people with whom they disagree, and talking about important human values.
All right.
Can I add a little bit to that, Rachel? Because I think I'm really glad you raised that. And I've lately been exploring the idea of philosophy is just the art of having a good conversation. And it's hard to have a good conversation because you quickly turn to the latest thing that I did or the latest thing that I ate or something I cooked, and it's all fine, but it's, you know, just sort of exchange of recent events between people and their lives. But once in a while, you can get into a really good conversation about meaning and about purpose and about perceptions and insights that people have had. And since we don't really get a lot of experience or models for having conversations of that character, people don't know how to do it. And a philosophy class can teach you how to have really good conversations, how to ask the good question, how to listen carefully to somebody else and raise the relevant question that maybe no one has thought to ask and would push the conversation a little bit deeper. So I'm glad that Rachel mentioned that.
We do have an email, and they're asking three questions, so I'll get those to you probably after the break. But Charlie, you raised an issue about practicality.
Mm.
Here, at least tangentially here.
Yeah.
And so, especially in the age of House Bill 265, and the legislature saying that universities are not just an ivory tower.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing what the legislature is saying. And we need to direct students to high-paying jobs, etc.
Right.
So I'll direct this first to you, Charlie. Is philosophy just navel-gazing, or there's some practical aspects?
Well, I mean, you know, you don't want to downgrade navel-gazing. but no, philosophy isn't just that. I mean, when I'm joking about navel-gazing, a bit of self-reflection and self-knowledge is always a good thing. But it can be overdone, I suppose. But what philosophy does is it of course, raises questions that you want your parents and neighbors to be thinking about in terms of what is valuable and what their obligations are and how they ought to be living their lives. So that the content of philosophy is not just far removed idle wheels, right, in human lives, but philosophical questions are about human lives. So that's directly relevant. In addition, the skills that especially Michael was talking about, the analysis and the systematicity of philosophy, is a set of exportable skills that you can take anywhere. It's often said that philosophy is the best pre-law degree because, from that joke that I was telling, that philosophers make use of the skills of lawyers, or I should really say lawyers are making use of the skills of philosophers, in pushing the argument further, seeing what consequences are. I tell my students, if you can understand Kant's moral theory, you can understand anything.
Right.
Right. Michael or Rachel, you want to take a crack at that?
I just find it astonishing when people claim that philosophy doesn't have practical use. I think the questions that are posed in philosophy are the most fundamental human questions, and they're questions that we really need a citizenry to be considering. So what does it mean to be a good citizen? What does it mean to be a good person? What does it mean to do the right thing? What counts as knowledge, and what are the best practices in terms of attaining knowledge? These are all really important questions, both personally and for a society. And on top of that, as Charlie was sort of alluding to, it's just false that philosophy students don't go out in the world and find good, well-paying, meaningful jobs, because employers really want employees that have these skills, that can think critically.
Yeah. Michael. I mean, it's an interesting question because people do invest thousands of dollars into their education, and I mean even on the sort of monetary sort of
return on investment
philosophy is by no means anywhere close to the bottom when people sort of study this empirically, and so that's I think there's a lot of evidence that philosophy actually has a great deal of practical value, that people find good paying jobs after majoring in philosophy. I think people have written extensively, say George Anders, about how philosophy or the humanities broadly has influenced the development of technology in say Silicon Valley and stuff like that. And I also sort of want to emphasize that philosophy is foundational to the American political tradition. And if you think about people like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, they're steeped in the philosophical tradition and the classical tradition, and that's in part what informs how they set up the country as it exists and why they set up the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all these sorts of things in the ways that they did. If you want to understand that better and to be involved with that conversation started by the founders and framers of the American Republic, philosophy is an indispensable stop if you're going to do something like that. The law point is a practical one, but it's also worth digging into that even a little bit more, because law is sort of central to how American society operates and how our political culture operates. And the foundational questions of law are philosophical questions, arguments about textualism, originalism, what's the role of the judiciary in a society? These are all philosophical questions. They're unavoidably philosophical questions. And so there's you can't, I think, do American politics and be involved in that conversation. And not that everyone has to major in philosophy, but philosophy has informed this tradition, and philosophical questions are as broadly construed, are sort of unavoidable.
All right, yeah, great. Good responses. So, to set the scene again, we're celebrating World Philosophy Day. That's this week. USU philosophers will be at the Logan Library on Thursday, 5 p.m. There's a panel, and that's free and open to the public. Logan Library, Thursday, 5 p.m., and USU professors are inviting you to ask us anything. And there will be free coffee and refreshments provided as well. We have three USU philosophy faculty members with us: Charlie Heeneman, Rachel Robinson Green, and Michael Otteson.
I'll hasten to add that while people are free to ask us anything, that doesn't mean we're going to answer everything.
Okay. Good point. Yes. You'll pick and choose. So, We're inviting you to ask our philosophers anything on the program today. So maybe you aren't able to be in Logan on Thursday or get first crack at the apple here as well. We do have an email already in. This questioner has asked three questions. We'll get to those after the break. And hope that you'll join the program here as well with your question for our philosophers. upraccess@gmail.com is the place to go. upraccess@gmail.com. upraccess@gmail.com. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. World Philosophy Day, you may or may not know. Well, if you've been listening so far to the program this hour, you do know. World Philosophy Day is Thursday. And as we did last year, it's kind of a nice thing. Philosophy professors got up an event. They're doing it again this year, USU philosophy faculty members. And they'll be at the Logan Library on Thursday, World Philosophy Day, 5 p.m. The panel will consist of USU professors Charlie Heeneman, Harrison Kleiner, Michael Otteson, and Alex Barrientos. And the moderator will be Mike Ashfield. After a short introduction, questions will be taken from the audience. The event will go from there. Free coffee and refreshments provided. Again, that's Thursday, Logan Library, 5 p.m. We're inviting you to get your questions to our panel of philosophers here, which include USU philosophy faculty members Charlie Heeneman, Rachel Robinson Green, and Michael Otteson. The way to get your question to us is by email, upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. So let's get directly to email that we just got in from Richard Green. He says, I have some questions for your guests. First one, is human existence ultimately absurd? Who wants to first crack
My
at
colleagues
that?
Both looked at me. I have taught classes on existentialism, and so that's fairly natural. I mean, that's a great question. When somebody says that human life is absurd, they mean presumably that there isn't a kind of purpose that redeems the suffering. That a person can ask, is a human existence worth the effort and the pain that's involved in a human existence? And somebody who says life is absurd says it's not obvious that it is, or maybe it's more obvious that it isn't worth it. It would be ridiculous, wouldn't it, if I could say, well, we've been working on this one for years, and we finally determined that human life is absurd or human life isn't absurd. It really is a question for every individual to try to sort out for themselves. And it would be presumptuous, I think, for anyone to try to answer that question for somebody else. It's possibly the most meaningful question that anyone can ask, the most important question, most fundamental question anyone can ask. There's certainly good reason for thinking that it's absurd. When you read Camus and Sartre and Samuel Beckett and so on, Kafka, Dostoevsky, but then many of those authors, even the ones that I just named, also come around to saying that they do find something. They find love. They find relationship to others. Perhaps they find God that redeems the apparent absurdity of a human life. How's that for not answering a question?
That sounded great to me. Michael or Rachel, what's your answer?
I like what Peter Singer says about this, the philosopher Peter Singer. He talks about the distinction between internal and external meaning. So I think that there's no sort of meaning built into the very nature of the universe. So in that sense, I think human existence is absurd. But I think you can find subjective meaning, internal meaning, by finding things in the world that matter to you. And Peter Singer adds that you can also achieve external meaning by doing good things for others in the world, and that you can achieve this connection between internal and external meaning by finding your subjective meaning by doing good things for others in the world. So that's a position I like.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, I think it is a serious and interesting question that different people have come on down on different sides of, though I do think that there's I think in our everyday lives, a lot of I think it's almost unavoidable to act as though our decisions and actions matter in some way. So one American philosopher, and he got his PhD in theology, who is part of this kind of American philosophical conversation that I referenced, is Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, you can look up, he taught philosophy courses. You can see what his syllabus was when he taught. I think it was at Morehead State. And there's somebody who's deeply informed about these sorts of big questions and is interested in this broader tradition. And his life's work was built around the idea that what we do matters, how we treat other people matters. And I think one of the reasons he's become what he has in the American political consciousness is precisely because I think most people agree on some level that it's not just absurdity and we can't shrug at it with indifference. These are the how we answer big philosophical questions about meaning, value, purpose, virtue are going to impact everything that we do in our lives. And I think a lot of people see the intuitive pull that says, no, we can't be indifferent about, you know, social organization, about our interactions with other people. So that's kind of how I think about these sorts of things.
So that would get us to Richard's next question. I'll have Michael take the first crack at this. Richard asks, in what ways does philosophy bear on the real world? You've just given an example.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's right. I think it bears on the real world in all sorts of ways. I mean, ethics, which is one of the, or value theory, one of the great subdivisions of philosophy, the consequences for answering ethical questions are enormous, and that's in part why you see extraordinary energy around these questions in our own society. Think about a question like abortion and the sort of energy around you know, whether or not it's permissible or impermissible. I mean, whatever you think about that, it's not inconsequential. And we can go down the list of sort of social, political topics that people really care about. And it, you know, how you answer those sorts of questions one way or the other is going to have all sorts of effects on other human beings. And what to note about ethical questions is that they're, in fact, tied up with metaphysical questions. Questions of ultimate reality and meaning and what is the place of human beings within the world. And so I think that there are all sorts of real world examples of how there's impact to philosophical questions. I mean, also I think on the epistemological side of things, the study of knowledge, people seem to care a great deal about science and technology and, you know, the foundations of those sorts of things impact us in all sorts of ways. I mean, Alan Turing, the great computer scientist, was a philosopher, and his work revolutionized the modern world because of its significance.
Michael, can I ask you to give a kind of brief description of your $1,000 project that you have in social ethics? Because that's as real world as it gets, I think.
Yeah, so we in my social ethics class, one of the things we do, because social ethics is an applied ethical class, I say, let's consider what is the best use of $1,000. What's the most good we could do with that? And so what I do in that class is I have students offer presentations and give arguments as to what sort of nonprofit or charitable organization would do the most good with $1,000. And so, I mean, the effective altruism is a movement that's been, you know, in the news recently, but that's, you know, philanthropic endeavors. There are so many good causes out there. Which one is the best one to pick? What's the best use of our money? That's a philosophical question.
And it's a real $1,000 at stake.
Real $1,000. Yes. Yeah. So, Rachel or Charlie, want to take crack at this?
Oh, on the application?
Yes, real world, yes.
Yeah, application to the real world. When I first started teaching at a different institution, my initial classes were at a different institution, and I remember passing this desk on the way out of the room where someone had carved, "Philosophy is pointless." And I was like, oh no, I hope that wasn't in response to my class. but I don't think anything could be further from the truth. Just about everything we do, either does or ought to involve a conversation about value. And I'll just take one example. Consider artificial intelligence and consider automation and all the things that are happening at lightning speed right now with respect to all of that. We must be having philosophical conversations about how this ought to go, about social organization, about what kinds of values we want to promote, or else there's going to be a kind of value lock-in and all those questions will be off the table. So I think human innovation, human social organization, all rely on philosophy.
Let me follow up immediately here. What kinds of philosophical questions do we need to be asking and answering about AI?
Well, algorithms are not going to make decisions on the basis of value, not unless we somehow program them to. This is something that I've been working on recently. So algorithms could do things like calculate consequences. So algorithms could be fairly good with, say, a utilitarian analysis of how things ought to go. People sometimes think of like self-driving cars as a very real example of the trolley problem, mm-hmm. right? So here, oh, the car needs to make this decision. Should it kill one to save five? Should it sacrifice the driver? Those sorts of things. But there are other kinds of moral values that it seems like algorithms wouldn't be very good at, like care. Like human beings, there are certain sorts of relations that are essentially care relations, and we are bringing AI and automation and robotics into those conversations and into those professions in ways that you might think don't capture the values we need in those areas.
Mm. I was at the dentist the other day, and as the dentist was working on my mouth, I started to wonder, how would I feel if this were an artificially intelligent robot working on my mouth? And immediately I felt horror.
Yeah.
Because of just what Rachel was talking about with care, that you would hope that any sort of dental robot would have the kind of algorithm that would know when to stop and when to ease up and whatever. But with the human, you can more or less take that for granted. I realize there might be horrible dentists out there, but generally not, of course. And I wouldn't trust that to an algorithm, certainly not yet.
Yes. Another real-world application that Michael brought up, I want to direct this to you, Rachel, ethics, right? Obviously, we're getting a little bit into that with the discussion of AI, but you're involved with the Intercollegiate Ethics Bowl.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
It's a debate organization, but it differs from debate in really important ways. So so in debate, teams are assigned positions for pro or con. In the Ethics Bowl, students argue for what they think the arguments best support, for what reasons and evidence best support, theory best supports. So students are given, in the fall season, 15 cases, and if they qualify for nationals in the spring, 17 cases that they're asked to construct construct arguments regarding. And so the real value of it that is distinct from the value of debate is it really emphasizes the skills of not being antagonistic, not being combative or aggressive, but rather trying to have thoughtful, engaged conversations with people who might hold different positions. So students provide a 10-minute presentation, then another team offers a commentary, and by the way, they might agree with you, and then they have to find interesting things to say in commentary. Then there's a response to commentary, and then judges ask the team just sort of whatever questions they think of for 10 minutes, and the students have to engage in active listening and be able to respond to those questions and think on their feet well. And the Utah State team that I co-coach with my colleague Mike Ashfield came in second at their tournament and are headed to nationals in the spring.
Congratulations. That's wonderful. These are real-world applications, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I'll ask Richard's third question, and I have a couple of questions that have been provoked by Richard. So, Richard, thank you for your email. It's provoked some rich discussion here. You can join this discussion as well with your question or comment for our philosophy panel by emailing us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. We are talking with USU philosophy faculty members Charlie Heeneman, Rachel Robinson Green, and Michael Otteson. We'll have more following this break. Thank you for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're honoring World Philosophy Day, which is Thursday. And on that day, Thursday, several USU philosophy professors will be at the Logan Library. That event begins at 5 p.m., and they're inviting you to ask us anything. This title of the event. The panel will consist of USU professors Charlie Heeneman, Harrison Kleiner, Michael Otteson, and Alex Barrientos. The moderator will be USU philosophy faculty member Mike Ashfield. Free coffee and refreshments provided. That, again, is Thursday at the Logan Library, 5 p.m. We're inviting you to get some questions to our philosophy panel here. You can email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Our panel here are USU philosophy faculty members Charlie Heeneman, Rachel Robinson Green, and Michael Otteson. So I had a question that was provoked by our discussion of Richard's first question. Let me pull that up again here. Let's see, what was it about here? Is human existence ultimately absurd? All right, and then our discussion. Mm-hmm. And the previous discussion earlier in the hour. So I want to throw this out. It's obvious philosophy and religion are related, mm-hmm. right? Some permeable boundaries. Mm-hmm. But or is there a strict boundary between the two?
Can I tell one of my favorite jokes?
Yes.
It's often said that that a philosopher is, this is by somebody that's not very enamored of philosophy, a philosopher is somebody who's like a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. And then and then the follow-up to that is that a theologian is somebody who finds the cat. There is, in my view, philosophy tries to cover all the possibilities, right? One of those possibilities is that there is a divine being who cares for us and has a plan for us. And once you kind of make that assertion or have that faith, have that belief, then there's a number of tremendously important and interesting questions that follow. So, of course, I'm a philosopher, so I tend to look at theology as like a special case of philosophy, right? That's philosophy being done under very special conditions, those conditions being a divine entity that cares for us. But apart from that, it's still the same questions. You want to know what exists, what our obligations are, what is real, who I am, what my future is, and so on.
Hmm. Michael or Rachel?
Yeah, I think that philosophy and religion are sort of inextricably linked. Maybe the first philosophical question that was in the Western philosophical tradition is something like, what is the relationship between sort of morality and what we should do and the existence of God in the Euthyphro dilemma, the Euthyphro dialogue? And I teach about medieval philosophy in some of my classes, and this is sort of like a defining question for the medieval philosophers about the relationship between, because we can define religion and philosophy in various ways, but if religion is a sort of built around scripture and revelation, there are questions about that, especially if there's competing claims about, who's been talking to God and what they have to say. And from the very beginning of Christianity and Islam and Judaism, and, you know, also if you go to Buddhism and Hinduism, all these traditions are wrapped up in philosophical traditions and theological traditions where they're trying to think through these sorts of questions. Think about somebody like Job in the book of Job. He has some pretty significant questions about ethics, about the place of human beings in the world, about God's responsibility to human beings, and you know, human responsibilities to God. And there's an argument right there in the Bible. It's a philosophical argument that both sides, he and his friends, are sort of prosecuting. So I think that religion and philosophy are just tied up with each other and have been for a long time.
Hmm. Rachel, answer this one.
Okay. Well, I think philosophy, one of the big questions of philosophy is, how ought I to live? Who ought I to be? What should I believe? And I always encourage my students, I always say to my students at the beginning of the semester, I'm not trying to get you to think anything in particular. I want you to develop the skill of creating a consistent, coherent worldview that you think that the evidence and the arguments best support. But that itself is like an interesting question when it comes to this, because some people think that religion is something that is supported by evidence and arguments, and other deeply religious people think that's the wrong way of thinking about it altogether, that religion is something that you accept on the basis of faith. And so that alone is a really interesting philosophical question.
Hmm. Well, I have philosophers with me this morning, so...
I'm so sorry, Tom. You should see a doctor about that.
He'll prescribe me something. This is perfect, though, because we've all been reading about this, and sometimes maybe we have people in our lives talking about, is it nihilism? Nihilism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nihilism. Yeah.
I'll just read you a couple of headlines here. So this is from the New York Times. The rise of right-wing nihilism.
Yep. Yeah.
So younger Republicans, right, mm-hmm. have a streak, apparently, according to this, of nihilism. The buildersmovement.org is taking it even broader. The dangerous mindset spreading across America, cultural nihilism among Gen Z. Mm. First of all, tell me a little bit about nihilism, and are you guys seeing this in younger people?
Well, Michael, you want to have a go at that?
Yeah, so nihilism is the belief that, on online they would say, LOL, nothing matters.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there is no such thing as right or wrong, that there's no such... I mean, there's different kinds of nihilism, so you could be sort of a moral nihilist and say, well, there's no real rules that say what is, you know, right or wrong behavior. You could be a nihilist about truth and the nature of reality, that there's no reason to believe one thing over another. I suspect these nihilism often sort of track, these things sometimes track together, but there's a lot of, I think a lot of that is getting at sort of moral nihilism. And these are, it's in a certain sense not super surprising, because I think a lot of the old meaning-making systems that people were really bought into, they don't attract as many people in terms of the percentage of the population as they once did. And so I think a lot of people don't know how to formulate or think about ultimate meaning, value, and purpose. And so some people just slide into a kind of nihilism where they're just like, well, nothing matters. My behavior doesn't matter. I can behave or act in whatever way I happen to fall into. And there's no argument against doing anything in particular or for doing anything in particular. Mm. So that's precisely philosophy in many ways is born out of a desire to combat this. And again, there's pre-Socratic philosophers and such. I'm oversimplifying, but in ancient Athens, you know, a democracy like our own, there was famously a sort of intellectual movement of people called the Sophists, who were at the very least relativists and might have been nihilists, depending on how you define those sorts of terms. And they ultimately said that there's no real objective standard or right or wrong. There's no better or worse way for us to live our lives or organize our communities. And Socrates, living in the 5th century in Athens, oftentimes is depicted in the Platonic dialogues written by his student Plato as fighting against this, as looking for ultimate meaning and purpose as a way of combating this sort of nihilism that many people thought destroyed Athenian democracy, because you get a collection of young people, educated young people in Athens, who are nihilistic about politics and don't care about how they treat other people, and that had disastrous consequences for that society.
That's ominous if you apply that to our country, right? Rachel, do you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I don't think it's the nihilism that's the problem. I think it's the conditions that give rise to the nihilism. I kind of think, how could young people be anything other than nihilistic, given the social conditions that we're in? And I think philosophy can do a lot here. I think philosophy has a significant role to play. So I teach ethics in, I volunteer and teach ethics in prison sometimes, and the students there have, they report that they find philosophizing, even though some of them didn't finish high school, they find philosophizing to be a really impactful, humanizing experience. And having conversations with other people in the philosophy class there, the group, makes them feel listened to in a way that they never have before. And I think right now, with all this array of social background that Gen Z is dealing with, they feel disenfranchised. They feel like there's not a clear path forward for them. There's socioeconomic inequality. There are all the problems posed by tech and surveillance capitalism and the kind of addiction that is intentional, right? The social media companies want you to become addicted. And students, young people, not just students, but members of Gen Z in general, maybe aren't encouraged to find the sources of meaning that they once found. And so I think it's up to us to try to reinsert important values into social and cultural life so that these people feel powerful again, and then they won't be inclined toward nihilism. Hmm.
Charlie, anything you want to say about this?
No, that's really perceptive, I think. And Gen Z or young people today are growing up in a world in which there never has not been an internet, right? And it plays a huge role in their lives. And given the strategies behind it, it's very hard to extricate yourself from that kind of electronic ecosystem of ads and manipulation and data harvesting and so on. So it becomes more important than ever to go out and touch grass, to reacquaint yourself with who you are as an organism and not who you are as various pixels are telling you.
You're a product. Right. They've made us into product.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Well, we have just 2 minutes left, and here's a big question. I'll just have you not elaborate, but answer the question briefly. This is from Richard, his last question. Who is the greatest philosopher ever?
Well, there's this guy, Richard Green. he's pretty darn good.
Good. You've been nominated, Richard.
One of the standard replies to that would be Plato. Alfred North Whitehead said that all of Western philosophy is nothing but a series of footnotes to Plato, which is an exaggeration, but not much of one. It's really kind of stunning. The more that I've read philosophy, the more I've been able to see that it was, in some ways, are anticipated by Plato. So just if you want to measure the greatness of a philosopher in terms of how much great philosophical territory they managed to cover in their lives, I guess I'd have to give the award to Plato.
All right. Michael?
I co-sign most of that. Yeah. I think it's hard to deny the sort of significance of Plato as a philosophical figure, particularly in what's broadly now called Western philosophy.
All right. Rachel, what do you think?
I'm going to offer an answer that just to say something different, because yes. I think the way the question is framed just encourages you to say a dead white guy. So I think there are some excellent contemporary philosophers. I think Martin Luther King Jr., you know, as Michael was talking about before, was an excellent philosopher who doesn't get enough credit as a philosopher proper. He actually wrote lots of books that people should read. I really like a contemporary philosopher that I really like is Martha Nussbaum.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. Just very briefly here, 30 seconds. So Plato, what should mm-hmm. people read first?
Oh, the Five Dialogues.
Okay.
He always wrote these dialogues, which are like plays, but don't put them on as a play. It'd be dreadful as a play. But they're dialogues because you're getting arguments, basically, for and against certain views. But the Five Dialogues is easily available. I'm sure you can find it online. And that's the best introduction to Plato there is.
All right.
His magnum opus is The Republic.
The Republic. Okay.
That's usually how that's pitched now. And what's interesting about The Republic, as with all of Plato's work, it's dramatic, so it has sort of literary and philosophical significance, and the sort of dramatic and the philosophical is tied up together. One thing about interesting about the Republic, if you really want something ambitious, is that it basically covers all aspects of philosophy within the text itself, and that's pretty unusual in the history of philosophy, that you would find a text that really gets at all aspects of philosophy, logic, ethics, aesthetics, metaphysics, epistemology, all in the same place. So,
all right, very good. Just have 10 seconds left. Okay. Anything?
Martin Luther King Jr., where do we go from here? Chaos or community? Martha Nussbaum, anger and forgiveness.
All right, wonderful. Some places that people can go do some reading. Thank you so much. We've been talking with USU philosophy faculty members Charlie Heneman, Rachel Robinson-Green, and Michael Otteson. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And on Thursday, World Philosophy Day, these and other philosophers will be at the Logan Library, 5 p.m. on Thursday, Ask Us Anything event, and that's free and open to the public. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.